answer the question.
The case that Paula was saying about going to a barbershop, it was a real case. One of our members have been harassed for maybe 2 years by the same guy. So we thought it was like, okay, so we don't want, what are the steps to follow? We don't want to go to the precinct. Why should we do all that? And I mean, this is a person that she knows, and most of the harassers or abusers are persons that we love. So why would we want them to go to a whole system? So we thought of just kind of organizing this. We had like, it was crazy because we had like security and like undercover ourselves. We called some of our allies. And so we were like walking around. We did like this strategy plan of how to, like, if the first step doesn't work, of talking to him and make him understand that what he's doing is wrong. Maybe we're like having crazy idea of taking pictures of him and putting posters all over the place and saying, this is a harasser, be careful, take care of your, you know, just like things like that, that make, just creative, alternative things that we were thinking about of how to not go to turn around and go to the police, you know, to the police to get help. So yeah, it was a real case.
Just one more thing. I know we're running out of time, but just around the question of like what to do with like young people who are like, oh, I want to go to college, I want to make dough, I want to get out of here. I mean, I think that what's important is like, you know, not to like talk at young people and like preach at them, but also to like to model. And so that's why it's really important for us that we actually like model and practice stuff, so that it's not just talking to young people about, oh no, there are other ways to like live, but it's like they actually have an experience of like that alternative. So like that's where we see our work is really like creating those spaces so that young people can have those experiences and start to envision like, you know, other alternatives for their lives.
And even in the product making, we were thinking of a strategy of how could it be for the person to create this product and selling it and getting half of that percentage or something, getting half of that percentage so they could sustain themselves. So.
All right, so you've been waiting a while there on the end.
Yeah, I think this is a very interesting discussion. I began looking at this whole phenomenon about 2 years ago when I saw an article in Covert Action Quarterly about George Soros. And many of the organizations that he provides money to. It's important to take a careful look at Soros and other funders like him and what their agenda is, because inevitably it's the kind of model that's being presented, like you listen on BAI, like this is the reasonable, moderate stuff, and you're an extremist if you're not really a part of that network and milieu of people with access to this money and sophistication. There's a whole prehistory to this. I've been recently reading a book about called The Cultural History of the Cold War, where you had like the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, you know, providing money up front for the CIA, you know, to set up like Encounter magazine in Europe with people like Irving Kristol to counter, you know, the Red Menace. And so inevitably, you know, the program of Soros is counter-revolution. And that certainly was the case in Eastern Europe. He actually had a hand.
So I don't want to cut you off, but we're kind of vibing here off of this discussion. So I was going to ask you either to wrap it up, maybe if you were, or to, you know, address what folks were talking about for the last few comments.
But I think you're raising an interesting point, and the point is that the level can be had at two levels. On the one hand, is like, do these philanthropic institutions that are really the pet projects of global capitalists, do they have an agenda that is counterproductive to what we're doing? And on the one hand, you could argue that, yeah, you know, the Ford Foundation, the history is kind of incontrovertible evidence that they had a hand in a lot of funky stuff. Okay, but then there's this other discussion that I think is, well, do we have any agency? I mean, and Sister to Sister clearly demonstrates that we do. Okay, we don't want the money. We don't want to participate. And I think part of where I feel the discussion kind of reaches a dead end, and I don't mean to cut into, I just want to kind of try to bring that point back in, is that we tend to equate their agenda with our hands, with us being shackled. You know what I'm saying? And the two don't necessarily, you know, just because they have an agenda and they're powerful and they have all this money doesn't mean that you have no agency around what you just ultimately decide to do. And I feel like that's the part that maybe goes to some of the questions that are out here around alternatives. So anyway, sorry.
And you know what? I've done a bad job trying to actually stick to these questions. I apologize. I think maybe I know, Mike, you had a comment. You were just raising your hand. I mean, if we can really, because it's 5 to 9, they told us, like, they need us out, like, everything cleaned up by, like, 9:30 because they're doing some rug cleaning thing tonight. So we're actually kind of getting towards the end here. So, you know, maybe keep in mind, you know, after these two comments, or maybe you can even, you know, lean towards them, you know, kind of some concrete, what are we saying, like some concrete funding alternatives for our movements that have been successful. And Paula, were you just going to direct response on it?
No, I'll add myself to
the staff.
I'm from the old generation of the 60s. What you left out, big must, was anti-poverty program. That brought up most people in my generation. Two first of us, big thing. It wasn't for foundation, any government. Our money you together got to kill us. Second, we were never given, as blacks, well, as blacks especially, American blacks, we never trained about business. It's always get a gig, get a job, never about business. And even though we had economic models from down south and across the country, we were never taught about business. Even people that come from other countries know how to start business. What you didn't mention, which I didn't hear, was how you were tapping into the bodegas, fast food restaurants like Jamaican, blah, blah. Where you're doing services, if you're giving them the service they want and money we can use. I think this is one of the funding alternatives you should go. You should go and say, hip hop. Positive hip hop is not on the radio, but positive hip hop sells on the street. Why aren't you connected to the hip hop generation selling stuff, setting up studios, getting people employed? Okay? What we could not do in my generation was say to somebody who wanted to sell drugs, give them a job. We had no control over jobs, had no control over housing. And what you just saw happen in D.C., 10 years of stagnation. My generation. They had a million-man march, a two-person women's march, and then nothing. Now it's all about more mobilization. Who are you mobilizing when you talk about people? Who was your targeted group? When I hear Bushwick, is that a block? Or is that just it's in that neighborhood?
A neighborhood.
Okay, can I walk and see people? I can go to a bodega and talk to a person. I can go to a store, stop on a stoop. What we got to task was we learned to go to court rather than go to the street corner. My generation left the whole group on the street for kids who created a billionaire business without one adult to be involved. It's called hip hop. I think that's your economic model.
And that's a good point.
Yeah.
I have Paula and then Kenyon. I know you want to kind of direct response to that, so.
Okay, I'll be short because I already talked. Sorry, I wasn't meaning to talk on that one. I guess around the alternative stuff, I think some of the stuff we've talked about is looking at how there's welfare, how it existed before in this country, and how it kind of was what let out the steam, you know, and made people never have to fully feel poverty in the way that people might feel it in other countries, and seeing the challenge of that, and people we met from Nicaragua came to the U.S. and kind of visited some of us doing work, and they were like, damn, it's hard here because even the poor people got big old TVs, and, you know, it's like there's that whole thing. And I think part of the parallel is this kind of funding, philanthropy, foundation world that kind of plays that same role on a bigger level for us. So it's like we never fully have to do it on our own, you know. We always can kind of get something out of them. And one is that we're all accounted for that way, like a lot of us that otherwise they wouldn't know where we are, what we're doing. It's like, it feels like it's a way to really keep tabs on everybody who's, a lot of us could be otherwise doing something they wouldn't know about, and that thinking about models that really like blow that up, and it's been feeling more and more to me that it's this kind of crazy internalized capitalism that is inside each one of us, like inside our bodies and our hearts, and that we can't just, we can't break out of it. So you mentioned something about people all putting their money in a pot and then like living off of that. I mean, and what EJ was talking about with different models, like we have the childcare co-op, or where we're bartering, or where we're pooling money, and where we have so far 3 part-time jobs that have come out of it in a few months. It's not much, but it's something. And looking at these models of other movements where even people who are on welfare or not, everyone pools their check, whatever they get every month, into a common pot. And from there, and some people are getting like welfare check of which equals $15 a month. Other people maybe have a job that makes 5 times that much. And all of that money goes into a pot. And from there, we do the work, that the work is our political work, but the work is also feeding ourselves, clothing ourselves, and housing ourselves. And that's kind of integrating our life into the work. Or because if our framework is not like political revolution is about toppling the state or finding the problems and, you know, pointing out the problems, but if political revolution and liberation is about creating the world we want to live in, which is a whole other thing, then we got to think about ways where we're creating a new way of life, of how we live every day, how we eat, how where we sleep, and how we use space, and how we can try to be more equitable on the day-to-day. And I feel like there's many of those cool-ass models out there, but what's holding us back, or even what's holding me back, is internalized like capitalism that's so deep that when we transfer to a a volunteer collective, we realize now some people have a master's degree and are going to get a job making 10 times what other people in the same collective now are working at a store for $7 an hour, when before we all made the same when we were in sister-to-sister pay. So actually going back out there has made, you know, our incomes go like this. But we haven't gone there to, you know, you go to the store and you go be the consultant for the Board of Ed, which we had one person go, and then all that money goes into a pot. We're not at that point. We haven't been able to take it to that step. Do you know what I mean? So, like, we feel like we made a step, but really it's just a first step into something that's way more deep, way more radical, and way more whole.
All right, so I got Kenyan. I'm actually going to say something after that, just a real concrete example. EJ, okay.
I just want to address, agree with this brother stuff, you know, certainly goes back to, you know, the kind of war on poverty programs and really with, you know, white funding that established historically black colleges, some black churches, you know, ties into all of that sort of stuff. But I also think, I mean, there's ways in which I think for black people in America, I mean, attempts at doing particular kinds of stuff, be it economic models, be it other kinds of organizing, I mean, were violently dismantled, right? So, I mean, I can't, like, discount the fact that, like, you know, black folks here have also learned when you try to do shit, you will be killed, right? And murdered, right? And the legacy of that and the kind of, I really think this depressing, you know, to sort of consider. And so I think, you know, I mean, I'm at a place where I'm trying to, like, as I think about, like, my particular communities or whatever that I'm, you know, kind of engaged in, how to do specific kinds of work in communities that actually kind of empower people to make, you know, different choices and based on some of the same stuff that I'm interested in doing, right? And some of the vision that I, you know, so that, you know, it's not about just kind of like applying something on, you know. I feel like that's sort of a place that I am. And some of that may not look like what kind of what the left considers, you know, particular kinds of work, because there's certain kinds of frameworks, the way like the left sort of talks about or looks at certain kinds of things, right? And some of that may not even be considered that, you know?
So I was just going to give a real concrete example, which it's probably the single biggest thing that check that we've ever gotten for the magazine was out on the West Coast, and I know in a few other cities they do these things called leftist lounges where they throw like these crazy parties like once a year, and basically each party is a fundraiser for like two or three like grassroots groups. And this, they threw this huge party there like a few weeks back, and they raised $9,000 at this party, and they gave each organization like over between $2,000 and $3,000, like straight cash, like no strings attached, you know what I mean? Like, here you go. Which, you know, for us, it was like, you know, it was crazy. And the reason I like that motto is because, you know, it's always like, you know, partying or politics, right? It's always like that dichotomy. And like, you know, we do our little, like, mixture of the two where we got, like, a little party, a little jar, you know, we got a little $50 at the end of the night or whatever. But, I mean, you know, we're talking about, like, real money where people are coming together. Like, they're building alliances just in putting this party on. Like, it's an amazing, like, mixture of people that are actually coming together to even do this. People are into it. They get, you know, in-kind donations from you know, community businesses, wherever. They get the space donated. They get the liquor. They throw this crazy party. Everyone has a great time. And, like, the organizations are spotlighted at the party so that, like, they had, like, 1,100 people come through this party, and they're all, like, getting information about the organization, all this stuff, and it's all integrated in this, like, really amazing, like, way. And, you know, it's just, you know, something I think we definitely need to think about in New York, because there's way too many parties going on where, you know, that money is going to, I don't know who, you know? Eric, or did you have something earlier?
No, I was just...
Eric.
I mean, real quickly, just to kind of bring together some of the Kenyon, is it?
Mm-hmm.
And Ron, you made some excellent points earlier, and I want to, the point around back in the 60s when, you know, people pulled their money together. Look, the bottom line is when our movements were strongest is when there was a strong socialist ethic among the grassroots. That's, I mean, it's not rocket science. When people felt more organically connected to each other around not socialism with a big S, but socialist ethic with a small s, we had strong movements. I think today, I would just argue that it's almost impossible to do what people did 30 years ago. The constraints, the market constraints, the policy constraints are just more difficult to have the kind of networks. All are kin. You can't do that. It's just not the same. So, in this other corner, we have the nonprofit boogeyman, right? But I don't think it has to be the nonprofit. I mean, why can't the nonprofit boogeyman really be an opportunity to kind of do some work with, I'm just playing devil's advocate, to kind of restore that capacity, to restore, to kind of counter some of the constraints, some of the limitations put on communities that can't have the same organic networks that it used to have. I guess I'm trying to make the argument for the nonprofit as a vital tool, because I think it's easy to dismiss it for all, you know, the things that are flawed with it. But the question of agency, I keep coming back to that. Can we be smart and strategic about what it can provide? Or is it just irredeemable?
My bad. I got you, I got Aura, and then I got... Oh, my bad. I'm totally pushing this up. All right, DJ. Aura. Go.
Okay. I guess, like, just this whole conversation around what was different in the 60s and what's, like, reality where we are now. And I think that that one, it's like it's important for us to talk about, like, we're talking about, like, this term, like, community, but I think, like, a lot of it is, like, a lot of our work now is building community and is creating community and really being intentional and thinking about what is it going to take for people to build enough trust, right? Because I feel like that's, like, the bottom line, what it's about, for people to build enough trust to be like, okay, I'm going to go work, I'm going to pull the money in, you can, like, spend, you know, X amount of hours, like, doing this stuff, and then together we'll put our money in and we'll, like, use that to kind of build and grow. And part of that is that we haven't spent enough time, especially, like, in the movements, a lot of people have been focused on, like, okay, I got to do the work. And, like, we got into that place where we're like, okay, we got to go to the meetings, we got, you know, like, we have to do this, we have this going on next week, we have to get this done. And then you forget about the relationship building, you forget about having conversations, you forget about, like, yo, you know, what's going on with you, how's your family? And, like, not having those conversations does set up a thing where it's like, no, we may be talking about a collective, but we're still, like, individuals within a collective. And part of the work I feel like we're in now is, like, really, like, how can we, like, be collective, like, all the time, not just when we're doing the work, but when we're living our lives. And that, you know, I guess back to Eric's question, I feel like if we are, like, one way that we could, like, use this whole nonprofit complex to our advantage is if we build nonprofits that are about creating collective, like, healing spaces or collective spaces for people to come together, so that that is what's going to create, like, the environment and the community for us to actually, like, do the more radical and revolutionary stuff.
Sorry, I have three people on stack, and I'm going to actually close it after that because we got to be out of here in 20 minutes, and that includes, like, you know, cleaning up and stuff. So three comments. One, two, three.
So one of the most exciting things for me about...
Sorry.
This isn't really a question. It's a set of ideas I want to put out there. You're talking... Well, a lot of people are talking about, like, culture, right? The way that culture interacts with things, and then this community-creating thing. And then people were also talking about what was happening with these youth who grew up in nonprofit groups. And that's my experience. I grew up in a nonprofit group that focused on actually creating community. It was mostly run by women of color, black women, and I grew up with all these friends and all these mothers and so on and so forth. And the thing I wanted to put forward, which kind of doesn't fit into any of these, but relates to funding alternatives, because I think funding alternatives talk about, like, the culture that what money-making or production produces, right? And for me, growing up in that nonprofit organization, I'm kind of trembling now because it's bringing all these thoughts together. When I left, and now I'm in college, growing up in a communal situation where that kind of socialist ethic existed is actually making it very difficult for me to actually make it through college, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you create, now you have these nonprofits all over the place who are creating communal ethics amongst people who eventually are going to leave high school, and most of them are going to be going into low-wage jobs, and a few of them are going to be going to college. Yet all of them have been raised in this communal ethic idea, right? And so they don't want to turn to the nonprofit because they grew up in a nonprofit, and they see their elders and their teachers going through all this stress trying to get grants, right, and not being able to do what they want to do. But they also know that they can't go into the system as it is, right? So you don't like the funding alternatives that are there. You've grown up in this communal ethic already that's kind of already starting to produce that radical thing that's starting. You know, I think it's already happening. So the issues that are coming up for me in the exact moment are what do you do now that culture is there? I don't think we're waiting for a culture. I don't think it's a culture that's impossible or that is gone now that the 60s are over. Like, a lot of people from the 60s are the ones who have started these nonprofits, who are infusing a lot of people my age with that ethic. So now that that ethic is in us, and now that we have these ideas and we have these desires and we want this new thing, like, what kind of culture, what kind of community is possible? Because it's even gotten to a level where I felt personally bad trying to rely on family members even to go after the dreams that I believe in, right? Where you feel like you're supposed to be going to college and you're supposed to be feeling miserable until you get your BA. And then you can go out and do your activism or whatever. Why is it that we feel bad? Where is that capitalist culture going into the deep parts that you were talking about? So I just wanted to put that forward.
To respond to something that Kenny said, but also, Steph, when we talk about, I mean, I really appreciate the suggestion to look at, like, models of nonprofit use in Latin America, and that I find really helpful, to not be, like, all wholesale condemning, but kind of critical thinking about it. But also, I think when we talk about sometimes this ethic that used to be there or ethic, you know, what are alternatives? Sometimes, I guess, for me, it's important, I'll speak really just for myself, important for people who identify or are identified as activists, right, to look at some of the stuff like what you mentioned in terms of New Orleans, like the ethics that you can see within non-activist spaces, right, and processes. And so, you know, just the two things that came to mind. So these are non-activist, concrete, successful other funding examples. You know, one, like, I can't tell you how many, I'm sure you guys talked to folks too, how many people said to me in the past couple of months, yeah, our workplace, we all got together and we had a fundraiser, we all put in money, blah, 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 for somebody whose family was in New Orleans, right? It wasn't for Red Cross. It wasn't for some any nonprofit organization or anything. It was that somebody in their community had family there. And there were so many, I mean, I can't even count how many people said that was the way they gave to, in that way. And, you know, and then also if you, and so that was really exciting, a really exciting part of how you saw kind of those out of, beyond the state family and religious and community networks kind of really shining. But then also, you know, if you think about, I mean, a lot of folks here have been the ones that remind me a lot about how, you know, how many communities in Mexico or different places survive on remittances from, you know, even often undocumented workers here. And so thinking about, or how many people in inner city communities, like, are one, only one person has a job or something and family and is, and spreading it around. So I guess it's just important for me to remember that stuff because, to not make assumptions about what mentality is out there or whatever. Because it sometimes maybe I'm actually just isolated from that, or sometimes there's just maybe one missing link between something that people are willing to do or are already doing, you know?
So last, for some alternative methods of organizing that are not nonprofits and that aren't movements that precede nonprofits that come from the global south and parts of Europe and pockets of the states are non-hierarchical forms of organizing, like you guys talked about. And I'm wondering if in organizing that's horizontal or non-hierarchical, there is really something that we should cherish and cultivate that can be a lasting force for change. I don't know if you could respond to that if you have time, but that's something.
You got to get out of here pretty soon. Maybe if you guys want to just make like 30-second like closing things or whatever, and then folks can go to the table.
30 seconds.
You get what? A minute and a half together.
I mean, one thing I'm thinking about is all this talk about entrepreneurial money-making stuff. Like, for me, it feels like that's a front of work that is really important because there's tons of micro-entrepreneur bullshit in this country and in the third world that's about teaching people to be capitalists. And it's like, how can you go from being an exploited person to being an exploiter of others? Get this little bank loan and then make your little business. And it's like capitalist training to me. And I feel like if we can flip that and make entrepreneurship about collective entrepreneurship, collective where it's not, you know, each person making money individually, but we're collectively trying to do it, like that's a pretty cool way both to fund our work, but to do political education in practice and education around cooperative economics, or different economics in practice. And we've had some pretty good experiences around that stuff.
Anybody else up front want to just close out with anything?
I just think that just like building up on what like Paolo is saying, that when it comes to like reorienting organizing so that it's around like a vision as opposed to like an issue, and that so that really like organizing and it's about like inspiring people, and when people are inspired, they're more likely to feel a sense of ownership or want to be a part of or want to join. And so I feel like that's an important piece in terms of like really like creating vision and coming pulling people together to create a vision and really inspire them, and that's part of what is going to make it sustainable and have people be willing to own like our movements.
I guess also the capability of just dreaming, just like everyone is so busy doing their own thing, and you're such an individualist, and just going to work, going to school, doing this, and just we forget about dreaming, period. And that goes with what EJ was saying, when you empower yourself, and it's like a domino effect. It'll go on to like this huge change. So.
The last point I would want to make is also around the nonprofit industrial complex and the autonomous movements. Help build these autonomous movements. If you have to do it outside your 9-to-5, well, that's the way it has to be. But also siphon unrestricted funding to the autonomous grassroots. Think of creative ways to do that. I think there's a whole discussion about how this money sits here, and it's restricted because there are program guidelines around it, but there's creative ways for us to get together to unrestrict it. And, you know, that conversation may be worthwhile.
So I just want to thank everybody.